Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative Podcast Network. Learn more and check out all the shows at TheWildInitiative.com.
You're listening to the Fish Untamed podcast, where we talk all things fishing, conservation, and the outdoors. Today on the show, I'm joined by Jake Roy, fishing guide at Wilderness Place Lodge. All right, welcome to episode 18 of the Fish Untamed podcast. Today, I got a chance to talk to Jake Roy, who is a fishing guide at Wilderness Place Lodge in Alaska. I actually initially got connected with Jake through Reddit and asked him if it'd be okay for me to pick his brain about how to do a do-it-yourself trip up to Alaska, since that's definitely something that's on my bucket list and I'm sure is on the bucket list of a lot of people. And I particularly wanted to talk about doing a DIY trip to Alaska because I think that Alaska is one of the few places that seems pretty exotic to most people in the lower 48, but doesn't break the bank to go and do. We go over everything from when to go, to how to hire a bush plane, to escape the crowds a bit, to how to actually get your fish packaged and shipped back home. It was just packed full of good nuggets about how to plan your own trip up there. So without further ado, here is my chat with Jake Roy. All right, cool. Well, do you just want to start by telling me about your fishing background and then maybe a little bit about guiding up in Alaska?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually have a little bit of a different story starting fishing. I haven't really fished my whole life like a lot of people have. I started when I was 18 fly fishing and then just kind of got way too involved, way too like everybody does. It's a pretty addicting sport. For those of us that are really into it, but just kind of took it from there and then got into guiding. Didn't really want to know what I wanted to do with my life, so you know, I figured I'd go to Alaska while I could, and here I am.
So. Fair enough. So did you start off fly fishing, or did you pick up like gear fishing first and then switch over?
So I was lucky enough, my family had a little cottage on a lake when I was growing up, so I had always kind of just tossed, you know, little swim baits and stuff like that, like once a summer for bass. Mm-hmm. But I was never really into it, and then I just kind of picked up a fly rod because I thought it looked cool, and that's what I ended up doing, sticking with it, and now I probably won't ever fish anything else.
So what got you up to Alaska to guide? Did you guide anywhere else first, or like what triggered that application process, I guess?
I mean, like I said, I just kind of didn't really want to know what I was doing with my life for a while. And then, you know, I kind of got sick of sitting behind a desk, and Alaska's kind of the path to get into the industry for guiding, you know, at least for first time guides. And I had never really guided around here. I mean, kind of like everybody, you know, you show some friends around or whatever, you know, you introduce a few people to it, and then I actually got certified as a casting instructor last year. So, you know, that definitely helps in doing that kind of stuff. you know, just kind of gets you into the industry, gets your foot in. I started going to trade shows and just, you know, talking to people. And I applied and got a job up there, and I've been going there ever since. So
you're not up there like year round then?
No. Okay. I am there seasonally in the summer for our summer season. So in the winter, I am, you know, I'm back on the East Coast for right now. In the future, next winter, I'll be hopefully either in South America guiding or on the Olympic Peninsula guiding for winter steelhead. So,
oh, that'd be a pretty nice setup.
that would be nice. That's the ultimate goal, but we'll see what happens.
So what do you do the rest of the year right now?
Right now, the rest of the year, I just work, you know, in an office job, and
okay,
they allow me to take the summer off, basically.
That's a nice perk.
Go up and guide. Yeah, it's pretty good, you know, having that opportunity. And you know, it's definitely cool to have an understanding employer that lets me do that. And then, you know, eventually I'll be guiding full time, so that'll be nice. But
awesome. Where in Alaska do you guide?
So I'm actually not in Bristol Bay like a lot of people are. I'm in an area called the Matanuska-Susitna Valley on a little river called Lake Creek. It's about 75 air miles northwest of Anchorage, right on the southwest edge of Denali National Park.
Okay. Is the fishing similar to what people would encounter in somewhere like Bristol Bay, like somewhere that people are a little more familiar with?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we got all five species, Pacific salmon, rainbow trout, grayling, and every now and then we'll encounter a Dolly Varden or an Arctic char, but they're not as abundant as they would be in Bristol Bay in that mm-hmm. drainage. And then we also have there's a little chain of lakes upriver from us where we fish for pike. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. So we've got quite the variety there. And, you know, we're a tributary of the Yentna River, which is a big river. And that's even a bigger tributary of the Susitna River. So we're on that drainage.
Okay.
And that's, like I said, it's about an hour bush flight from Anchorage. So traveling there, you would fly into Anchorage, hop on our charter, and then, you know, float plane right out to our lodge. So
okay, so like what's a typical day for you, or like a typical trip, I guess, even if it's multiple days than that too, but what's a typical trip like if someone wants to come up and take a trip out with you guys?
It's usually they fly in, you know, we'll get them unpacked, get them off the boat. So typically on our like pickup drop off days, the flight is at 11. So they'll come in at 11, we'll bring them back to the lodge, they'll get settled or whatever, eat. It's a full service lodge, which is pretty nice, so we don't have to handle any of that as guides. You know, some places are, you know, most places in Alaska actually will have like food and stuff, and you know, in their standing cabin, so that's nice. And then they'll eat lunch. Basically, we just, you know, kind of sit down and talk to them, set up a fishing regimen, and we go out and fish. You know, it's pretty straightforward. You know, we have 40-horse jet boats that we just run up the river, and
okay,
we have access to the lower 10 miles of the tributary. And then we actually do overnight raft trips for those that are a little more adventurous, from the headwaters, which are in a place called Lake Chelatna. And those are 6 days, typically 67 miles afloat. So it's, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day of pretty hardcore floating. It's pretty cool, but.
Oh, nice. And so it sounds like people aren't generally coming in for just like a day. They stay there with you guys at the lodge.
I would say it's probably 60-40 people that stay multiple days. The average, I would say, is 2 to 4 days, anywhere from there. And then we'll have, you know, I probably had five people that were there for day fishing that would either fly in from Anchorage, or they would take a day to fish if they didn't know what else to do while they were in Alaska. You know, which is, not everybody is in Alaska to fish, which is
right,
you know,
or their families aren't.
Right, exactly. So, you know, we get a lot of, you know, I probably this season I had three people, I think, you know, husbands where they were there, and they brought their families along, and the husband they're like they had like a day off from a cruise or something like that where they decided to fly out. So there's a couple people like that, and which is nice for the proximity to Anchorage and relativity to most places in Alaska, because nowhere is close in Alaska. So.
Right. So what do the place. What do the families usually do while they're there if their spouse is fishing?
A lot of them will actually come fish with us.
Okay.
But we have a main lodge, and there's plenty of stuff to do there. We actually have very limited Wi-Fi when the generator's running, so they can do that. But mostly they'll fish. I mean, we have there's a pretty good hiking trail. Most of the people that'll come are into the outdoors, so they've got hiking. We've taken them out for boat rides, and sightseeing, and that kind of stuff. There's a lot of wildlife in the area, so a lot of people do wildlife viewing and that kind of stuff. Or they'll just sit by the river and hang out. So
just a nice place to be, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't complain about it. You know, it's not a bad place to be.
What was it like the first time you got? I assume that. Well, I guess I shouldn't assume. Had you been to Alaska before you went up to guide your first season?
I actually hadn't. No. So when I got up there, I was kind of just like, didn't really know what to expect. Being from the East Coast, I'm used to in the winter. You know, not that it's not dark there in the winter, because it is, but you know, I'm used to not very long days, and you know. This past summer, actually, the weather was kind of insane, but I don't know if you heard at all, or I know most people in the fishing industry did, about the like extreme heat that they had, but it just the 20-hour days of sunlight are, you know, kind of wild to get used to at first, and then you realize, you know, okay, this is just how it is, and you get used to it. And then I would probably say the biggest shock to me was the wildlife. And just how kind of rich and green everything is. And I guess that's from the salmon. They're the base of the ecosystem and mm-hmm. pretty much every watershed in Alaska. So,
right. You said that you kind of just get used to the like long days. Do you find that once you're up there and going through that for, you know, a couple of months, you just completely get used to it? Or is society a little bit different up there dealing with that compared to the lower 48, where, you know, people never experience something like that?
I would probably say it's definitely a little bit different part of society up there. There's a few locals that are in that area, and they are, you know, they're used to it because that's what they live. But, you know, you get people that travel from all over the place to come to Alaska, and everybody seems a little bit amazed that the sun actually doesn't go down that often. So it can be kind of shocking for some people, and other people are just are completely used to it already for, you know, whatever circumstance. So it's kind of a mix of both, I would say.
Are there any things that you feel like, well, I guess I wouldn't say taken for granted, but for example, do they still treat it as nighttime, you know, come like 8, 9 p.m.? Or is it like, well, the sun's out until, you know, 10, 11 o'clock at night, so daytime goes until that time? Or do people still kind of turn things off?
Again, I would say that's a mix, too. It kind of depends on how hard the people are fishing. If somebody wants to get out there, you know, really get after it at 4:30, 5 in the morning, absolutely, let's do it. But most people, I would say we start around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and then go until dinner time. And then if people want to go out after dinner, you know, we'll take them out after dinner. But our lodge has a policy of being back by 11 o'clock every night until August. And then we actually have to be back at 10 because the sun actually does start to set a little bit. And the animals will get pretty active once that happens. So you don't want to be out walking around at that time. But I would say most people treat it like a normal day, and that gives us a break, that gives everybody at the lodge a break, and that gives them a break, you know, so they're not, mm-hmm. they don't get burnt out.
Sure. Do you have any fun wildlife stories?
Oh boy. actually, yeah. So this summer there was a cow, moose, and two calves that were living on lodge property. When we got there, and one of the first nights we were all there, there's 10 of us. We all on lodge property in cabins, to a cabin. So there's no running water in the cabins. We're, you know, we're in the middle of nowhere out there. And one of the guides I was working with this summer, he woke up in the middle of the night to use the outhouse. And he came out of the outhouse, and there was the cow, Moose, just kind of walking down the path. And he said he put his hands up, just turned around, and walked right back into the outhouse for 10 minutes because he did not want to deal with that. And then, you know, there's the typical, I've had bears pop out behind me, you know, 5, 10, 15 feet on the bank while I'm in the water with clients. You know, we carry bear spray and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that gets a little wild. You could just kind of turn around, back away real slow and make sure, you know, because they're not there for you. They're there for the fish. But just back away real slow. There's actually not a ton of brown bears there. We have a lot of black bears, though.
Oh, okay. Is that what I picture?
Yeah. Everybody thinks huge grizzlies when they hear Alaska. But actually, back in 2013, the valley was getting overpopulated with brown bears. So Fish and Game had a bounty on them. So they were kind of hunted down to where they're not super around the populated areas anymore. But they're actually starting to bounce back a little bit with the moose population. So I saw two this summer, but I saw countless black bears, you know, just a lot. And then actually another good wildlife story. This one wasn't really scary or sketchy or anything like that, but we had the really good fortune of we were upriver one day out on the boats. And we see mated pair of bald eagles just kind of flying around. And all of a sudden they start going way up. And then we see them lock talons. And we got to watch them do their mating ritual, which was really, really cool. So I don't know if, you know, how much you know or any, you know, other people know. But what they do is they lock talons and free fall from like hundreds of feet in the air as like a trust exercise, I think, because from what I understand, they're monogamous and mate for life. So that was really cool to watch. But that, you know, they're everywhere out there. Beavers are everywhere out there. we've got quite a few different things. So,
yeah, I've heard of that mating ritual, but I've never seen it. And I'm sure most people probably never get the chance to see that. So
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that was that. I had never seen anything like it before. And, you know, it was definitely cool to watch.
I think the coolest thing I've ever seen an eagle do, I've seen it happen two or three times, is an eagle grabbing a fish that's too big for it and having to like swim it to shore. I'm sure that's got to happen like all the time up in Alaska, because I'm sure those fish are, you know, bigger than the average fish down here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've seen eagles where they gorge themselves too much and can't take off because they weigh themselves down too much by eating too much fish. I've seen eagles try to pick up 30 plus pound kings, try to fly, just absolutely no way they're doing that. So
you'd think they'd like get used to it.
You'd think, but you know, they're predators, and they see something big that they know is going to feed them for a while, and instinct takes over.
I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they just kind of, you know, screw it. We'll dive in.
You kind of touched on something that I was going to ask. You said that the brown bears are like, they're not there for you. They're there for the fish. Is that kind of a theme across Alaska? Because I feel like whenever I hear about bear attacks, I tend to hear about them in places like Montana. I don't hear about a lot of grizzly attacks from Alaska, and I'm not sure if that's just because I'm, you know, not as connected to Alaska, or if it's just because that you can kind of cohabitate pretty easily, just because, you know, I won't bother you, you won't bother me, kind of thing.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm not an expert on the situation by any means, but I'm kind of in the same boat as you. I mean, I've heard about them in Montana. I've been to Montana a few times, and you know, I've always heard of way more bear attacks happening there. I would have to guess that's probably what it is they just have so much more abundance of a food source. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're focused on. Cause especially in places like Bristol Bay, where it's just, you know, the sockeye run is millions and millions of fish strong. You know, they're so focused on that, and that's their main source of prey, and they don't see people all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, rarely if ever, at, you know, at this point, which is, you know, I guess a good thing. I would have to say they don't know what you are, or they know you're not a threat to them at that point, so they just kind of ignore you.
Okay. Well, cool. I want to transition over into the kind of DIY stuff, if you're cool with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've never been to Alaska, but I think it'd be really fun to go up one day and do some fishing. But I do like the idea of either doing maybe a couple days guided and then doing a do-it-yourself trip, or just doing a do-it-yourself trip from the start. And I think this is one of those subjects where I may not even know what I don't know. So I'll pepper you with some questions about it, but also feel free to jump in and like let me know anything that you think, you know, someone might want to know if they're going to do DIY.
Yeah, for sure.
I guess the first part, well, I don't even know what order to go in because there's not really a clear order, I feel like. But if someone's planning to come up, how long do you think that they should come to get the, you know, quote unquote full experience of fishing up there?
That really all depends what somebody's goal is. If somebody's goal is to catch a lot of fish, I would honestly advise coming up. Not that you won't catch a lot of fish any time of year up there, but I would come up later in the summer. And probably minimum, if you want to experience the most, I would say minimum 5 days. You know, a lot of people do a full week. Some people, you know, will take a week to fish and then a week to travel, you know, and see other stuff because there's a lot to see there. Mm-hmm. But I would say probably minimum 5 days if you want to get the full experience of fishing.
And you said late summer, like August, is that?
Yeah, I would say the last week of July going into August, and then the first 2 weeks in August are usually they're firing pretty good usually. That's when the chums come in. That's when the coho or silvers come in. You know, the pinks are usually already there. And then the trout are just gorging themselves on eggs. And I know that's not everybody's cup of tea. I was never the guy to fish egg patterns or whatever until I went up there. And then, you know, the only way to catch a rainbow at some points is either fishing a flesh fly or pegging a bead. And that's what you got to do up there. So it's probably your best opportunity to catch as many different types of fish as Alaska has to offer. You know, or you come early summer in June when the kings are coming and you target the big boys.
Okay. So coming a little bit earlier, you can target those larger fish. But if you come later in the summer, you're kind of overlapping a bunch of different species. And
absolutely.
Kind of,
yeah.
Okay, cool. I feel like I feel like most people would probably opt for wanting to catch a bunch of different types. I'm just speaking from my own point of view, but like, I'd rather catch a bunch of different things.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, it's pretty cool that there's so many, there's an abundance of so many fish species there. I've seen one person do a salmon slam in a week. It wasn't in a day, it was in a week. And that's tough to do because by the time every species is in the system, the kings are really starting to kind of zombify up, but a couple will still eat, but if you want to catch the most species, by far later in the summer is the best thing to do.
Is that what you find that most people want when they come up, or do they have, is there an overwhelming like species that everyone wants to catch, or an unusual species that, you know, you do get some interest in?
Yeah. So I would say there's usually two sets of people. There's the people that came to Alaska to fish and they're hardcore fishermen, and I find a lot of those people are there for silver season or king season. King season because they're gigantic fish, and they fight really hard and they eat swung flies. That's my favorite way to catch fish for them, is with a two-hander and swing a fly. And until you've had a king salmon eat a swung fly that's, you know, 15 hours from the salt, it's kind of tough to describe them. And I think a lot of the more hardcore fishermen will go for that. And then, you know, people that aren't quite as into it and might want to be might want to experience other things in Alaska, will probably go for the other stuff.
Okay. If someone's coming up and is bringing their own gear, like let's assume that they're not going to, you know, go with an outfitter or rent or anything like that.
Right.
Is it fairly easy to bring your own setup up there in terms of everything you'll need? Or do you need like a different rods for different species? Like if someone's coming up and wants to do like salmon, trout, and let's say, I don't know, like grayling or pike or something else that's up there, can people get away with just a single setup for all those things and just switch out their flies? Or are you looking at different rod weights and different lines and things like that?
I would say if you're looking to target salmon and you know, maybe pike or something like that, you could probably get away with a 7-weight setup for okay. everything. You know, you might even want to go up to an 8-weight at that point, unless it's king salmon, and then I wouldn't say anything less than an 8-weight.
Okay.
At minimum. But trout, I probably wouldn't go heavier than a 5-weight. I fish a 3-weight for them.
Really?
Out there. Not a lot of people go that light, but our drainage doesn't have those big lake run rainbows that everybody, you know, conflagrates with Alaska. They're more, you know, they're still really nice, but they're more in the 18 to 20 inch range.
Okay.
You know, but they're still eating streamers and all that kind of stuff. So I usually go for a 3-weight or a 4-weight, especially early season when you're kind of drift smelt patterns right near the surface, and that's my favorite way to fish for them. But if I had to go with one rod for Alaska, I'd probably say a 7 or an 8-weight.
Okay, so it sounds like, you know, in an ideal world, you might have a 7 or an 8-weight for some of the larger fish, and then maybe a 4 or 5-weight for the trout. But if you had to just pick one, you know, got to go to the largest option.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, I would probably say 7-weight is a pretty safe bet for just about anything you'll catch, unless you get a freakishly large fish, which can happen.
That could happen if you've got a 5-weight on. You could get a trout that's too big for that. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know some of the guys in Bristol Bay fish for the trout with 7-weights, and they're needed.
Well, that's not a bad problem to have.
No, it is not.
What other species are right around where you are or in all of Alaska? Like if someone's coming to Alaska, what all species do you think they could check off their list?
Oh man, there's a lot. So you've got all 5 species of Pacific salmon. If you go down to the Aleutians, which is really actually hard to get to because they're islands. They're not connected to Alaska by the Alaskan Highway. You can catch sea run cuts. You can catch steelhead. You can catch these weird fish. They're called sheafish. I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
No.
A lot of people, they're in the farther north parts of Alaska. People call them freshwater tarpon. They're basically just overgrown minnows that are anadromous. And they'll go back and forth from the ocean to the rivers, and people catch these huge, huge sheafish, like double-digit pounds often. And nobody has ever heard of them. They're really weird looking. They're just like giant minnows. But that's a fish that not a lot of people know about that I think is pretty underrated as far as Alaska goes. And then you've got the Arctic char, the dollies, the rainbows. You know, there's the pike, the grayling. There's a whole lot to target out here.
Do you have walleyes that far north?
You know what? I don't think so. I personally don't know if they're anywhere in Alaska. And the drainage I guide on, we do not have walleye. The pike we have were introduced illegally in.
Oh, okay.
Probably 50 or 60 years ago. And they were super successful. So we actually are required by fish and game to kill them if we catch them, because they're an invasive species. So I don't believe there's walleye, but I could be wrong.
That's just one of those fish that I think of as being, you know, in the lower 48, I think of it as being a northern fish, like Minnesota, Wisconsin, that kind of area. But it seems like there's like a band that goes across the U.S. or the, I guess, North America, where they're not farther south or farther north than that. But I mean, maybe they are and they're just not where you are. But I'm just wondering because I associate them with being up north, but I never associate them with Alaska. And I just wasn't sure if maybe you guys had them up there.
I'm sure they're in here. I know lakes in the Yukon have them, in northern Manitoba, like there's a Great Slave Lake has huge walleye that I know people troll for and stuff like that, and that's about the same latitude. So maybe we do. I just haven't heard of them. I'll be honest, I've never fished for walleye, so I'm not super into it. So I wouldn't know.
So if someone's coming up, is there a specific area? Like, I know Bristol Bay is like obviously the place that everyone's heard of. Would you say that if someone's coming up, it's pretty imperative to come to a certain region in Alaska, or is fly fishing kind of, you know, you can go anywhere you want and find something to catch?
I think you can fly fish pretty much anywhere you want in Alaska and you'll find something. You know, there's always going to be spots that are more conducive to gear fishing. There's always going to be spots that are more conducive to fly fishing. I think as a general statement, anywhere in Alaska, you'll be able to go, you'll be able to catch something with a fly rod though. I mean, Bristol Bay is obviously the number one place, but there's a lot of other places that are pretty, I don't want to say underrated in Alaska, but not nearly as well known. Just because of, you know, the fame that Bristol Bay has for being the largest wild salmon run on the planet and, you know, all the 30 inch plus chrome rainbows that come out of those tributaries. But, you know, I mentioned earlier, the Aleutian Islands, they have the strongest coho run in Alaska, and they're huge, huge fish. You can fish the Yukon River for chums, which are actually, they're the longest migrating salmon species on the planet. The chum run and on the Yukon River, like I mentioned, those she fish. In northern Alaska, you've got Good News Bay out in the more western part of the state. You've got Yakutat down in the southeast and the Tongass rainforest. And, you know, there's a lot of different opportunities for people in Alaska. So
you're not kind of pigeonholed into an area with everybody else. Like there's plenty of places to go that aren't, you know, what you're going to find if you just do a quick Google search for where to go fish in Alaska, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you could drive everywhere in Alaska, which you can't, unfortunately, you could spend the rest of your life there fishing for, you know, whatever you wanted.
That's a perfect segue into my next, I guess, set of questions, which is probably the thing that intimidates me the most about, you know, when I think of trying to go to Alaska to do a DIY trip. And that is, when I picture going up there on like a guided trip, I picture float planes and jet boats and things like that. If someone comes up and just lands in Alaska, how do you get from, let's just say like Anchorage, like a major airport, how do you get from there to, you know, the spot that you're about to take a cast? I assume you might take a bush plane like to a smaller town. And then can you generally find some places to just go up and start fishing, or do you need to rent a car? Like what's the process of getting from a major hub to a place that you can catch fish?
Yeah. So the bush flights are really the main method of travel, of getting places, I should say. There's not a whole lot of road systems in Alaska. There's the major Alaska Highway, you know, that comes up from Washington through Canada, and go through there, and that's the main road system in Alaska. So you can take that from Anchorage, and there is a road system, you know, from Anchorage down to Talkeetna in those areas. And you can get to fishing by renting a car there and, you know, driving. And people do it, and people do it all the time. People drive all the way up north to Fairbanks and go grayling fishing and salmon fishing up in the Arctic. But by and large, it's going to be float planes or bush planes with tundra tires, or, you know, you stay in Anchorage and you fish in Anchorage.
So it sounds like if you're stuck in a car, you basically either have to go somewhere that you can hop out of the car and fish, or that you could do like a short hike to. Which in Alaska, yes. I'm sure there's probably not a lot of places that are a short hike, because it sounds like the roads don't go that many places.
Yeah, from my understanding of it, I haven't been super far north, but the highway network is not very strong there. You know, there's the highway, and then obviously it goes off into towns and stuff like that. And I know there are places where the actual highway goes next to rivers where you can like literally pull off on a bridge like you would somewhere in the lower 48 on a popular pool or something like that, you know, Colorado or Montana or wherever. But by and large, you're either hiking or bushwhacking or, you know, floating. You know, a large majority of people float in Alaska. They'll do remote floats or they'll do day floats or that kind of stuff.
Now, is that DIY floats? Or, like, how would one access a raft or a boat?
I would say most of it's guided without fitters. I'm sure you can do DIY floats if you have the experience. Obviously, I would never do that alone. I would always be prepared for, you know, bears and that kind of stuff. And then whatever weather Alaska can throw at you, because it gets crazy.
The weather?
Yeah. The weather, be prepared for rain, always. Be prepared for wind, be prepared for thunderstorms, be prepared for forest fires, be prepared for heat, snow, whatever you can think of happens during the summer in Alaska.
Sounds like the mountains here. We've got snow in June and July, and then, you know, you might get a 60-degree day in the middle of winter.
Yeah. I mean, this past summer was a rough one. It was like 90 degrees where we were for like 2 weeks straight, which is like, I think, the hottest stretch in Alaskan history. And there was, you know, quite a few major forest fires. I think there was 3 or 4 that had a huge impact on Anchorage with the smoke. And I'm sure living in Colorado, you're fairly used to that phenomenon.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
So, yeah. I can imagine. But yeah, the weather is kind of crazy out here. It's something else to consider. But as far as roads go, there's not a whole lot of infrastructure to get places. So
if someone comes up and decides they want to take a plane, be it a bush plane or a float plane, couple questions on that. One is, how do you book that? Is that something that comes through an outfitter, or can you just hop a ride on a bush plane somewhere as a DIY fisherman?
So there's a little place next to the Anchorage airport called Lake Hood. It's one of the largest float plane airports, I believe, in the country, where there's charter companies, there's companies that do tours, there's private pilots, there's just dudes that really like to fly planes, there's women that really love to fly planes that'll take people for a fee, there's air taxis, all that kind of stuff. You know, you can either find with a quick Google search, or if you do want to do a day or two with a guide, typically if it's through a lodge, they'll have either a charter or their own plane.
Okay, so you can basically just buy a ticket for a bush plane. And is that something you buy in advance, or do you just show up there and there's just, you know, pilots waiting around with their planes to take whoever comes up?
You would buy that in advance a lot. It's basically like Uber for fishermen, you know, to get places, because there's people that do, they'll do day flights where it's basically an air taxi. They'll pick you up in the morning, you know, they drop you off, and then you set a meet point and you're back at that meet point and at the end of the day, and they'll pick you up.
So where, I assume, well, I guess float planes have to land on water, obviously. I assume bush planes have to land somewhere that there's, I mean, does there have to be an established landing strip? How do you choose where you want to go? Like, if you come up and request them to take you somewhere, do they have a list of spots that you can choose from? Or are you like, hey, I found this spot on the map, like, can you get me there? How do you determine where you go?
So that would probably be pilots, whatever you're thinking. I'm sure a lot of them have established places they like to land and take off and stuff like that.
Okay.
I've seen, I don't know if you're familiar with float planes at all, but one of the more popular models is a de Havilland Beaver in Alaska, because it's what they're just really good for what they're designed for, which is taking off and landing in really short distances with large amounts of freight. And then, so on a float plane, obviously you need a body of water, but a lot of them will have Tundra tires, which are those big bouncy rubber tires you see on the small planes. Mm-hmm. And I've seen planes land in 50 yards, 100 yards on little gravel bars or beaches or stuff like that. I mean, I've seen a bush plane land while I was guiding somebody in 100 feet on a little stretch of gravel bar. They're pretty versatile. If you're a good enough pilot, you know, they can get them into some pretty crazy places. You know, I was stunned. I couldn't believe the plane landed there. But he was there. Didn't even fish. He just pulled out a beach chair, sat there for a few hours, and took off.
It's like our cars down here.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
So do you if you get a ride somewhere, can you? I mean, do they stipulate how long you can be there? Can you be there for just a day, or can you say, "Hey, show up in a week, I'll be here," and they can just do that without, you know, verifying that you're capable of being out there for a week on your own?
I probably wouldn't do that. Maybe. I've never heard of that happening.
Okay.
I would advise strongly against that.
Okay, fair enough.
Just because there's so many things that can go wrong in a week, and if you're not at the coordinates you're supposed to be, and the pilot's there, he can't wait for you.
Okay.
Yeah, there's certain restrictions for flying and that kind of stuff. But I just know, I have experience either talking with people or doing it. If, you know, it's like, I think I paid $300 in Anchorage for a guy to fly me out to the Russian or out into the middle of nowhere, and drops you off, picks you back up at the end of the day before the sun really starts to set.
Okay, so is that a tip? That was going to be my next question. Is that like a typical price? How much should you expect for a bush plane ride to cost?
Yeah, it varies. I would say anywhere, probably a couple hundred. So anywhere from, you know, 200 to 300 or 400, and that all depends how far you want to go or where you plan on going, and that I'm sure varies pilot to pilot as well, just based on their experience levels, or, you know, if they fly with an outfit, if they fly with a charter company, if they're private, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so it sounds like you know, if you've got the money, you could just rent a bush plane every day and go somewhere different. But I'm sure there's probably a lot of people who come and do a couple, you know, flights places, and then maybe just fish closer to home just to save a little bit of cash.
Yeah. A lot of that's what a lot of people do. If you're not staying at a lodge, I know the local fly shop here, one of the owners who I've become friends with over the years, talking to him, he has specifically done that in Alaska before, is he flies to a different river every day for a week. And just fishes there. And I know that's what a lot of the lodges do in Bristol Bay, is they have their own float plane and they'll fly to the Naknek one day, and then they'll fly to the Quijack, they'll fly to, you know, a number of different rivers in the system, just to vary, you know, where you're fishing.
Is it pretty crowded? I hear about, you know, a lot of people coming to Alaska to fish, but it's such a huge area that I have no real concept of. You know, when you're out on the river, how many people a day are you coming across?
That is a huge, depending on where you are.
Okay. Let's say you haven't, like, booked a float. I assume if I'm paying someone to fly me out in the middle of nowhere, I would sure hope I'm not running into a bunch of people. But
yeah,
let's say you're closer to town.
Yeah, so if you're doing that, chances are you're not going to see another person.
Okay.
And then, as a disclaimer, don't go out alone. Bad idea. But I would say, you know, don't go to the popular places. The Kenai River during the sockeye run is shoulder to shoulder.
Okay.
You know, and everybody knows the Kenai because there's huge rainbows. The sockeye's run in there. You can walk across them practically. But it's a lot of people shoulder to shoulder, flossing or snagging, whatever you want to call it, flossing their limit of sockeyes and taking them home. You know, you could call it combat fishing. But then again, there's Bristol Bay, which is super popular, but a lot of it is incredibly hard to access. So it's only accessed by the lodges.
Okay.
So, you know, they have rod limits at the lodges. You know, they can only have so many people there at a time. So you're only going to see those people, or, you know, you're going to go to all different rivers in a day. Or for our lodge, for instance, we're the only ones that have access to uprivers. We're the only ones that stash our boats upriver. So we're the only ones that have access to it. So you won't see anybody else except for other guides from the lodge I work at, or, you know, other guests at the lodge I work at.
It sounds kind of like a nice mix of, if you want to go up and catch your limit of, you know, sockeyes, you can go combat fish. If you want to kind of have a little bit more of an exclusive experience and but still be a little closer to home, just go through an outfitter. And if you want to see absolutely nobody, then just hire someone to fly you out to a river in the middle of nowhere, which is kind of nice, because I feel like somewhere, you know, for example, I'm in Colorado, you can't really escape people. You know, even if you choose to, you know, hike a really far distance, you might still encounter an outfitter who hiked someone up there, or just someone else who wanted to get after it. But it's not so separated like that, because everyone can pretty much access everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like we've made the point that there's, Alaska's big. It's a huge, huge place, and there's a lot of things to do there. I mean, there's a lot of water. There's a lot of water in Alaska, and every body of water that I could think of has fish in it. You know, there's so much to cover out there that if you wanted to, you could never see another person. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter how often you fished it, you would never see another person there.
And I'm sure it's not too hard. Like, if you do a Google search for where to fish in your area and just don't go to the first couple places they list, I'm sure it's not hard to find places that, even if you aren't completely alone, that you're not shoulder to shoulder with people. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
It only takes a little bit of effort to find out where the crowds are going to be, and then just don't go there.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, you can say that really about anywhere.
Right.
I think it especially rings true for Alaska, just because of the population density is in like three places, and then, you know, it's hard to get other places. So if you want to find somewhere where you're alone, you can. If you don't want to do that, and you know you want to catch your limit of sockeyes real quick, because it's easy to do there, and you want to be around other people, go to the Kenai. There's so much opportunity there for fishing that it's hard to narrow down things to do without, you know, having specific people's interests in front of you, you know.
Mm-hmm. So if someone wants to come, like, let's assume that someone is coming to take some salmon home with them, do you know what the process is of getting, let's say, your limit of fish and then actually getting it back to the lower 48?
Yeah, so I can only speak specifically for what the process is for the lodge I work through.
Sure. We'll use that as an example then.
Yeah. So as an example, what we do, you know, say you catch your limit of fish this year, you take home your limit of fish for 3 days. We take them home for you, or we take them back to the lodge for you, excuse me. We fillet them up, vacuum seal them, freeze them. And then there's a couple options. The lodge that I go through, we have a deal with a meat packing company in Anchorage that will professionally process the meat for you. You can have, like, there's a bunch of options. Like, you can smoke it, you can cure it, you know, do a bunch of stuff with it, and then they'll ship it for you. The charter company we work with has these fish coolers that you can rent from them to fly home with your fish as luggage, and you can check it, and then there's always the option to ship it.
Okay. So it sounds like it'll be a little bit more work if someone's not going through an outfitter and having the benefit of somebody to freeze their fish, vacuum seal it, stuff like that. But
yeah,
if you're able to just find a service that can freeze it and vacuum seal it for you, then you can mm-hmm. just either ship it or fly it home as any other piece of luggage.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, and just as a disclaimer, the place that we work through in Anchorage, the professional meatpacking place, does have a weight limit.
Okay.
So you might run into that issue. So say you only keep one or two fish that you wanted to take home, or something like that. The weight limit there is 10 pounds of fish, which is, if you fillet, is probably three fish. If you're catching bigger fish, I know one person this year that I guided took home 44 pounds. So it's, and that he was only there for 5 days. So it's not hard to hit that limit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, again, that's just speaking from what I know about, based on what, the lodge I work for does as far as shipping stuff.
Is that service the one that will, is that a shipping service? Like, I assume that you could bring, you know, if you get a certain luggage allowance on an airplane, you could fill as much of that with fish as you want.
Oh,
is
yeah,
that,
absolutely.
Is that the
yeah.
packaging that they have the limit on, or the actual, like, shipping? They'll ship it 10 pounds for you.
They'll ship, so they process it for you and they ship it to your home address. It's a 10-pound minimum, I should say.
Oh, minimum. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it's a 10-pound minimum because it's a meat processing plant, basically, for fish. And, you know, it's quite frankly not worth it to them to process one or two fish.
No, that makes so much more sense. Because I was like, that just seems really low. Like, I feel like people got to be bringing back, you know, way more than 10 pounds when they go.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like I was saying, I mean, I had a guy bring home 44 pounds. A lot of people bring home 20 plus pounds of fish.
Okay.
For a multi-day stay.
Which are the preferred salmon to bring home? I hear bad things about things like chum salmon. I don't know if that's a myth or if there's actually some that are way better than others.
There are. So a lot of people tell you that king or chinook is their favorite. Personally, I'm a big sockeye fan.
Okay.
They have a more oily, delicate flesh than a king. And those are the big red fish. If for people that don't know what a sockeye is, the ones that the famous salmon that are really bright red when they get all colored up for their spawn. And then followed closely in second place for me would be coho or silver salmon.
Okay.
They have really bright orange flesh and it's really tasty if you eat it fresh. Chum is good if you catch it really, really fresh, like really chrome or already in the ocean. If there is any color to a chum at all, I would personally not keep it. Their flesh just gets really mushy. It's not that it tastes bad. It's just a very off-putting texture.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that they're not great, but I've never heard what makes them not great.
Yeah, it's just they change really fast when they come into fresh water.
Okay.
And, you know, within just a couple days, they go from chrome to, you know, that classic green goblin looking chum with the purple mm-hmm. bars on it. Those are not something you want to take home to the family to feed them.
they don't look particularly appetizing. I mean,
no, no, they don't. But I have also heard that they're really good smoked. So, you know, it's all taste and preference. And personally, I don't like pink salmon.
Okay.
Which they taste kind of like nothing.
So good or bad, depending on whether you actually like salmon.
Right, right. Yeah, that's basically what it comes down to. And I know, and again, the fresher the fish is, the better it's going to taste in all five species.
Of course, yeah.
When I say, you know, when I say fresher, the closer they are to the ocean or the less time they've spent in fresh water, the better they're going to taste.
Right. I feel like that seems to be the case kind of across the board with fish. Like, I mean, they're coming up to die. They can't be getting
exactly.
You know, better.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a very good point.
So what is the licensing system like in Alaska? Both the cost of a license and like what options there are in terms of time periods to buy a license.
So you can get, I believe they sell daily licenses, they sell lifetime licenses, they sell, you know, annual ones. Annual, I believe, for out of state is $100.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
No, it's not. It's not bad. But like a king salmon stamp is $150.
Oh, okay. So yeah, tell me about the stamp system then.
So the stamp system is for kings in my drainage, because this year actually the fishery was closed down. We weren't allowed to target them. Neither was commercial fishing. Neither was subsistence fishing. So for
really?
The first time in that drainage, everybody was shut down, not just either, you know, sport fishing or subsistence or commercial. They're having a fairly rough time, the kings. they're starting to bounce back a little bit. We saw a lot of fish this year spawning, which was really great to see. Yeah, so that's why you have to have a king stamp there, and they're $150. I am not 100% positive if that's Alaska-wide or just the drainage I'm on. I know a lot of places in Alaska to fish for steelhead, you need a steelhead stamp. And then, as far as I know, there's no other stamps. And the other funny thing about Alaska system or Alaska licenses, to get your guide license in Alaska, it's just an add-on to your fishing license. It's completely free.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. So, to be licensed by Alaska Fish and Game, you buy your fishing license, buy your king salmon stamp or whatever, and then it's just an add-on like on their website. It just says sport fishing guide, and they give you an ID number and whatever. But if you get stopped by Coast Guard or Fishing Game or something like that, you need to have your 6-pack Coast Guard license as well.
Okay. So it's that's something separate than through Alaska. Okay. So it sounds like well, I guess you weren't positive if the stamp is just for your drainage or statewide, but it sounds like if someone's going to go, it's probably beneficial to looking at getting your license, like where you're going to fish, or at least knowing where you're going to fish.
Look, they do change regulations based on drainage.
Okay.
So know the regulations where you want to fish. Some drainages had closed king season, some did not. Some had silver season closed halfway through the season because the water levels were so low, because of the heat. This past summer. So just always pay attention to regulations, and I think that's probably a good rule no matter where you're going to fish. But in Alaska, pay attention to regulations. They update them and change them a lot.
Okay. Do you know why the kings were particularly affected versus the other four species?
They're just a very cyclical fish, and they're the most sought after. The commercial fisheries, it's just not sustainable, to have commercial fisheries, to have sport fisheries and sustenance fisheries all targeting the same run of 20,000 fish. We didn't hit escapement for 3 years in a row. So they shut it down in January this year before the season. And it's just they're very cyclical. But they're coming back up. I've been told stories of before I was there in 2011, 2012, that those are the best king years they had ever had. So we'll see. We'll see as time passes what actually happens. But that's what I know about it. I'm no biologist, so can't tell you exactly what's going on, but from what I see, it's just loss of habitat, changing in the river conditions and over, straight up overfishing.
I'm surprised that they, well, I'm not surprised because I don't know, the specific situation that's going on right now, but I'm shocked that even subsistence fishing is taken down. I picture that as being the one thing that's usually still open places,
That was very surprising when I heard that. Even commercial fisheries. And there's a whole lot of politics that go
Oh, I'm sure.
into that, which I won't get into. But I mean, I'm surprised that even because they have lobbies and all that kind of stuff that where the commercial fisheries, have fairly, large amounts of influence, when it comes to that kind of stuff. And then ADF&G said no. We're keeping it closed, and it was just because we hadn't hit escapement in 3 seasons, where they were just like, all right, it's nobody takes them, and I think it's because there's not like an active Native Alaskan tribe in the valley,
Okay.
that will actively do sustenance fishing. So take that with a grain of salt, but they closed all three.
Sounds like it, if you're coming up to fish for King specifically, it's probably worth checking before you come up to make sure that not only it's open, but also that it's a good year for it. Because it sounds like it's you know, they could just be a bad year even if it's open.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very specific to drainage as well.
Okay.
I know a lot of drainages had really good king years this year. And I actually can tell you that we had a good one. We just weren't allowed to target them, which maybe that's why it was a good year.
Yeah, it's probably good. Let him bounce back.
Exactly. So, I mean, I can tell you that I saw thousands of fish just floating. You know, they're fire hydrant red when they're sitting on their reds. And you float right over them and you can see these 3 and 4 foot long gigantic fish just sitting there, and there are thousands and thousands of them just stacked up. So that was very good to see. And, you know, based off what we saw, we think we did actually hit escapement this year. So we're looking forward to see what they actually do. Personally, I wouldn't hate it if they kept it closed for half the season or only opened it to catch and release, just to make sure everything's all right. But, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do, and we'll see what happens. But definitely check whether the king season is open or closed if you're coming to Alaska. I would say that for all salmon species, just because, like I said, the fish and game changes the regulations a lot.
Mm-hmm. When you first said that you saw thousands floating, I thought you meant it was a bad thing. Like, you saw them floating, like, dead.
Oh,
and I was like, oh, that's so sad.
No. I was floating around. No, but you do see a lot of dead fish in Alaska. That's another thing to be prepared for, the smell.
Oh, okay.
Nobody ever thinks about the smell when there's just thousands of fish carcasses piled up on the riverbanks.
To be clear, that's like ones that have died that are supposed to die, not like they've all just been killed off by something.
Right. Yes. Yeah. You know, it's the natural process of things, and they have one of the more unique life cycles of any animal on the planet that I can think of.
Mm.
And it's kind of awe-inspiring to watch an entire run of fish, you know, just die. and you can see the whole cycle year after year, and you can see the young fish coming back. You see the smolt run, and it's pretty awe-inspiring as far as that kind of stuff goes. But it also does smell very terrible.
Yeah, it's probably like a, you know, on one hand, you're happy to see, you know, so many fish coming back up and knowing that those carcasses are all going to go, you know, back into the cycle and everything. But at the same time, you're looking at it and it probably doesn't look that pretty at the time.
Oh, no. They're all white and patchy and zombified. And just, you know, they're rotting fish.
Right.
And a lot of them will still be swimming while they're basically dead. Which is kind of wild to see. You know, there's a reason they refer to them as zombies, because they act like it. The instinct to get upstream is so strong that they will literally go there until they're dead. They won't stop trying to swim upstream until they're dead. So it's a pretty wild phenomenon to see, if nothing else.
Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, this kind of transitions into the last thing I wanted to ask about, but you know, I'm sure that even non-anglers could go out there and appreciate just seeing something, you know, so crazy that they've never gotten to experience before. You know, I think you can't see that elsewhere.
No, there's not a lot of places on the planet left where that's an available thing. I know in the lower 48, you've got the Pacific Northwest and some spots in California, and there's always the Great Lakes for salmon. But,
I'm sure it's just not the same scale, though.
It's not. I can tell you from experience from fishing the Great Lakes and the Pacific Northwest, it's not the same scale. It used to be in the Pacific Northwest, you know, but we won't get into that. But it's things in Alaska are still going really, really, really strong for these fish.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
You know, unfortunately, there's a few projects here and there that could have an effect on that, Bristol Bay and other places. But, I mean, I think the sockeye return this year in Bristol Bay was 53 or 4 million fish.
Even more of a reason to protect it.
Exactly, which is just that number of fish returning to one system is mind blowing. And then actually in the Cook Inlet where Anchorage is this year, I don't know how true this is, but this is what I was told, is that when we actually had the strongest pink salmon run we've had in a long time, is that when they made their push, they increased the tide by 2 feet.
Wow.
That's how many fish there were. So it's pretty insane.
I think any fisherman would be happy to look out and see a 2 foot wave of any fish coming toward them.
Yeah. I don't care if it's goldfish.
No.
I
mean,
yeah, that would be quite the experience to see. I did not see it. That's just what I was told by a biologist. So well, I don't know how true that is, but
well, we can dream.
Exactly. But as far as non-fishing goes, if you like the outdoors at all, Alaska's a must-see, in my opinion.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask, just to kind of finish things out, is what other things during that time of year are worth doing in Alaska? Because, you know, when I think of Alaska, I think of certain activities that you can't, or certain experiences even that you can't get down here, like Northern Lights and dog sledding and stuff like that. And obviously dog sledding is, you know, winter activity, but what else can you do up there in the summertime when you're not fishing?
Hiking, biking, you know, anything you can do in the lower 48, you can do in Alaska in the summer. It's a lot of people, you know, it's crazy how often I'm still asked, oh, aren't you cold up there? Or, you know, isn't there snow on the ground? I'm like, no, it's summer. it's not in a perpetual
It's not the North Pole.
Yeah. There's a lot to do up there. I mean, there's people run glacier tours, sightseeing, animal, Brooks Falls and Katmai National Park if you want to go watch bears, swimming, surfing. Down in Yakutat, I know there's a huge, like, weirdly cult surf following for that particular swell. Just really anything you can think of that involves using your 2 feet to get outside, you can do in Alaska.
So it sounds like kind of an ideal place to, you know, maybe you can't get time away from the family to come up for a fishing trip, but you could just bring them up and,
yeah,
you know, everyone
absolutely
can do something.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned Northern Lights and stuff like that. Best time to see those is end of the summer.
Oh, perfect.
It's tough. You need a clear night. And then they don't really go strong until September-ish.
Oh, okay.
And even then they're typically farther north. But you can still see them, and that is a wild sight. Let me tell you that I saw them once this summer, really late, like August 24th, I think I saw them. And it was real quick, just a couple green flashes, but it's something you never forget. That's, I think, really my takeaway from Alaska is like every day I saw something that I will never forget for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I love that place, and I'll go back there until I physically cannot.
I feel like this conversation makes Alaska feel a lot less daunting. Like, I think the biggest hurdle, and I think I mentioned it before, but just not knowing how to get somewhere, just because I think a lot of people come up and do get a guided trip, and not to take away from booking a guided trip if that's what you're looking for, but I know there's probably a lot of people who want to come up and just do it DIY like they do any other trip, and it sounds like it's not actually that difficult to pull off. For the cost of a plane flight up there, maybe one to several bush plane flights out to places, and the cost of a license, and then just shipping your fish back, it sounds like that's essentially all you have to pay for.
Yeah, it's very doable for DIY, and a lot of people don't think that. And in the summer, Alaska has more national parkland than any other state, you know. So, I mean, you can go to Katmai, you can go to Kodiak, you can go to the Tongass National Rainforest, you can go to the Arctic, fish for grayling. I mean, you can go to Gates of the Arctic National Park, where there's one road in, and fish for grayling. You know, it's pretty insane how much DIY there actually is out there, when, you know, all you see all over Instagram is, you know, people in front of float planes with their guides on jet boats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially for, I mean, it's obviously you know, part of the U.S., but it feels, I think, a lot more exotic to people than just thinking of it like another state.
It absolutely does.
You kind of get the benefit of, you know, an exotic trip with the, you know, I don't want to say the same cost as fishing in the lower 48, because odds are you don't need to, you know, hire a bush plane to get anywhere down here. But
right.
But you, if you hire a guide down here, I mean, a guide is going to be more expensive than $300 it takes to hire someone to fly you out, and you, now you have the whole river to yourself. So
right.
It doesn't sound like if you, you know, you can get the same or better experience for around the same cost.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fairly cost effective if you're able to afford, you know, getting there. And flights aren't super cheap to Alaska. You know, I think one way they're like anywhere from 300 to 500 or 600, but that's depending on the time of year and stuff you buy them. But I mean, like,
still,
you said,
for what you're getting
for $1,000 to $1,500 for, you know, 2 or 3 days for DIY, and that's if you choose to go on the bush plans or whatever. Mm. Yeah, you can fish a lot of water.
Sweet. Well, we can get things wrapped up, but do you want to just quickly share where people can either find you or the outfitter you work for on the web or social media?
Yeah. So, I mean, my Instagram is just at JakeRoy27. You know, I just post pictures of fish mostly and flies that I tie. But and then the outfitter I work for is Wilderness Place Lodge. We are about an hour outside of Anchorage. The website is wildernessplacelodge.com. And, you know, check us out. I'll be there this summer, and feel free to reach out to me on Instagram. Feel free to book, you know, through the lodge, and I'll be there. We'll put you on some fish.
Awesome. Well, I hope people will feel a little less intimidated by, you know, planning a trip to Alaska. And if they don't want to do it DIY, then definitely reach out and book a trip.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hopefully people feel less intimidated by Alaska. It's an intimidating place, but in a good way.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Jake. And I really appreciate you coming on to share.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, and that'll do it. As always, if you liked what you heard, go ahead and go over to the Wild Initiative podcast. You can subscribe there and get my shows bi-weekly on Thursdays, as well as all of Sam's other shows throughout the week. You can also find all my episodes on fishuntamed.com in addition to backcountry fly fishing articles. You can find me on social media under my name Katie Burgert on Go Wild or at fishuntamed on Instagram. And I will see you all back here in 2 weeks. All right, bye everybody.